Well, thank you for being here today. Dr. Kendra-Mohn said yesterday, you always have to appreciate that people could be napping, and they're here instead. So I appreciate that you're here. I just got back from Holden Lake about an hour ago, so constantly taking swigs of water. I'm trying to rehydrate. Thanks for being here. This is our third section on reconstructing community with our transgender siblings. And so far, we've done kind of a 101 basics on gender and how we understand gender and how we've understood gender in the past. And then on Wednesday, we did a big Bible session all about gender in the Bible. And then today, we are doing our final, what do we do now talk. That's the plan here, is the sort of, what about all of this? What do we do with it? So that's the plan. We're going to start out, as we always do, with introducing ourselves to our neighbors with our name and our pronouns. If you have not done this before, your pronouns might be he and him, or she and hers. They might be they, them. They might be other pronouns that people may not be familiar with yet, but we're going to practice some of them later. So if you could turn to your neighbor and just introduce yourself quickly, that'd be great.
Okay. Hi.
I want to talk for a minute about why pronouns are important in the everyday sense. I think it's a totally normal question to ask, why do we do this? Why are pronouns important? Why do we have to pay attention to pronouns? And just to give you sort of an imagination exercise, I think the way that some people understand trans folks, they imagine what it might be like to wake up in the morning and feel like a different gender than the one that you are. So say you're assigned male and you identify as male, you imagine what it might be like to wake up and try to understand yourself as female, but that's not exactly how it works. A better analogy would be to say, imagine you are exactly who you are right now, and you wake up tomorrow morning, and everybody is treating you like a different gender than the one that you are. And you have to keep trying to explain to them, no, that's not really what's going on. When we talk about pronouns, the reason that they're important is because if you can imagine how you would feel if somebody would use the wrong pronouns for you, day after day, that might feel kind of a little bit weird, right? Something might rankle a little bit there. One of the best ways that I've talked about how having the wrong pronouns used for you feels is it feels a little bit like, say I'm having a conversation with somebody and they use the wrong pronouns for me. It makes it feel like they're talking to this sort of cardboard cutout of the me that they think that they're talking to. They're not really talking to me, they're talking to their idea of me, right? And so that's why pronouns are so important, is because it allows us to talk to the person we're actually talking to and not to our idea of that person. So that's just a little bit of kind of groundwork for why pronouns are important. And we're going to do more practicing with pronouns in a little while.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I fully understand why they're important. But we're in a little enclave here where I think we would feel safe to ask this question of what are your pronouns. Mm-hmm. If I go out into central Minnesota and look at someone who maybe doesn't realize that I might even perceive them as a different gender than they feel they are, that could be very offensive, couldn't it? I'm a little uncomfortable. I want to do it. I understand why we should do it. But it seems a little, it could be misunderstood.
Sure. Did everybody hear that okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So that's definitely, you don't want to accidentally other somebody by being like, what are your pronouns? Because you look different and I feel like I should ask, right? That's a totally normal thing.
I'm trying
thing
to be respectful of that.
Right.
Being very disrespectful.
Right. So what we have found is that within communities where everybody uses and talks about their pronouns, whether they're trans or not, it becomes something that's so normal that it doesn't end up being an othering thing. Mm-hmm. So for instance, one of the examples that we might talk about later in terms of putting this into practical use is, is if you have a name tag Sunday at your church, everybody put their pronouns on their name tag alongside their name. Not just if you're trans, not just if you're gender diverse, but everybody. Because it's a little bit about the seeing the water we swim in kind of thing, where it's like if we think of trans people as the weird other and we don't recognize that we have an identity as cisgender folks, if we're cisgender, it's kind of like when we talk about race, if we only talk about people of other races or ethnicities and we don't recognize that we also have a race or ethnicity as white folks, right? We have to be able to recognize the water that we're in. Mm-hmm. So when we make pronouns something that's normal for everybody, it's less othering for a specific group. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
But if you're in a situation where you feel like asking is... Mm-hmm. Just seems like it could end up being very inappropriate or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just use their name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So refer to them instead of saying she or he. Just say their name instead.
Yeah, that's a really great backup. If you are like, I don't know if it's okay to have this conversation and I don't know what I'm doing, just using somebody's name. We do that a lot with God, right? When we talk about God, instead of using pronouns for God, we just say God. And sometimes it feels a little weird when we get into like God, God self, and you're like, that feels weird, but like, that we're more used to it when we talk about God a lot of the time than when we talk about humans. But just calling somebody Tom or Greta or whatever and not using pronouns if you're not sure is better than accidentally using the wrong ones. So it's kind of a backup, a fantasy. Cool. Anything else about pronouns before we keep going? Okay, cool. Oh, wait.
Yeah, this maybe is a really dumb question, but are there people that use she and not her and hers? Like, why do you have to list all three?
Oh, no. So that was a question the other day, too, and I should have clarified. Listing all three is not required. Some people will just say, I use she, her pronouns, right? And they don't list all three, or I use she as a pronoun. I just listed all three so that we would have all the sort of parts of speech in there, for example. Yeah. Cool. All right, so we also talked a little bit about our group commitments to each other as we had conversations. We didn't get to have as much conversation on Bible study day as I wish we would have been able to have, but we're going to have a lot more conversation today. So as we talk together, these are sort of the commitments that we have made to each other so far: to lead with curiosity, to listen closely, to use I statements, to assume good intentions, and not using shame or blame. So those are our sort of commitments as we're here in this space talking about these topics. Are there any other things that we would like to add to our commitments before we go on today? Okay, cool. All right, well, we'll stick with those then. And if we have a point where things maybe get heated or people are not sure what's going on, we can always come back to our commitments before we move on. So, a quick review. We talked about this on Monday, and then we made reference to it again on Wednesday. We're talking about gender as it is seen in these sort of three facets. So, gender is made up of your body, your identity, and your expression. And I have these sort of three facets here, but you'll probably notice that there's a lot of overlap. For instance, you couldn't have an internal self-perception of your gender if you didn't have a body with a brain in it, right? So there's some overlap here when we think about these three dimensions of gender. But the reason that we talk about them is because we recognize that our bodies are given an assigned gender, or some people say an assigned sex, based on your body parts, so we recognize that. We recognize that people have a gender identity that doesn't always match that thing that they've been assigned, right? And then we recognize that gender expression is something that everybody uses in different ways. Gender expression is different across cultures. Different cultures are gonna have different ideas about what clothing looks feminine, what clothing looks masculine, what hairstyles look feminine or masculine. So our gender expression is sort of the outward expression of the internal bits in the first two parts of gender. So just reminding us of that, reminding us of about some of that language, a couple of other vocab bits to remember before we go on. Remembering that sexuality, or what we might think of as orientation, is separate from gender. They are two different things. And if you were here on Monday and you had the little Venn diagram where we said, like, these ones are over here and these are over here, and there's a couple in the middle, just remembering that sexual orientation or sexuality is separate from gender. And we're going to be really honing in on the gender part of things today. And then just a couple of identities underneath what we think about as the trans umbrella. So a trans man is someone who is assigned female at birth but who knows themselves to be male. That's me. I'm a trans guy. You also have trans women, someone who's assigned male at birth, but who knows themselves to be female. And then we have non-binary folks who exist outside of what we think of as the gender binary that says all people must fit into two boxes, man or woman. They exist outside of that. And then transition is the word that we use to describe any sort of actions that people may take to align their gender identity and their assigned sex, or their body and their identity.
And clarification, a trans man or a trans woman could be considered, for instance, a trans man, even though they have not done any change to their gender expression, the way they dress, or have done anything in terms of a physical
transition. Yep, correct.
So
transition is not required for being trans. That's not a requirement. For instance, you may be a trans person who decides not to transition in any particular way, or you may be a trans person who can't be out in all areas. Maybe you can be out at home and at school, but not at work. And in those cases, your gender expression is going to have to kind of ride that line, right? So yes, you're right on the money there. Any other questions before we go on? Okay, cool. So let's get into it. What do we do with all this information? The first question that I want to ask is, why is allyship important? Why is trans allyship important? And I'm just going to bust all these numbers out here because they're important numbers. And if they feel overwhelming, it's because this is an overwhelming issue in a lot of cases for folks within the trans community. Recognizing that 41% of trans people attempt suicide, recognizing that within communities where if you are a trans person of color, your suicide rate is almost around 75% because you have the overlapping marginalized identities. Keeping that in mind. One thing I want to say about the suicide rate, some people will say, well, you know, if being trans is not a mental illness, why is the suicide rate so high, is essentially the question. The answer to that is something called minority stress. And I think we talked a little bit about this on Monday, but minority stress is something that can be experienced by anybody who is a minority within the place where they live. And minority stress is essentially, the way that I like to describe it is, you're living in a world that's not built for you. And that might be you can't see yourself in role models. It might be that you've never seen anybody like you in leadership. It might be that you can't find any bathrooms that are safe for you to go in. That kind of stress can compound over time and can lead to negative mental health outcomes. So minority stress is what's giving us this high suicide rate. Recognizing that trans folks are also facing a pretty horrific murder rate, specifically trans women of color, black trans women and native trans women are at the highest risk for murder. 2017 was the year that we had the most trans murders, and it is what it is. Recognizing that we talked a little bit on Wednesday about how sometimes the fear can outpace the actual reality of what's going on. And there's a lot of fear around trans people in certain gendered spaces and how trans people are gonna hurt other people. Well, it turns out the actual statistics show us that trans people are the ones being hurt. So just recognizing that that's sort of an out of whack statistic. And then recognizing that trans folks exist in all facets of our society, and that we also have to think about the ways that trans folks are dealt with within the judicial system, trans people who are incarcerated, and then trans people who are immigrants. Of the several people now who have died down at the border, we have had a couple of trans women who had conditions that were neglected by ICE, and then they eventually died of that condition. So recognizing that this is the sort of reality that we're living in, it makes it all the more important to think about what we can do, right? So another reason that allyship is important, because gender diverse people are already part of our churches. There are, right now we think, about 1.4 million trans people in the US. There was a really cool survey that was done in 2015. It was the first ever self-reporting survey for trans folks within the US. They had never tried to do something like this before. And they had thousands and thousands and thousands of people that responded. And it was a really cool thing to see. But when they talked about religion, they said, you know, have you ever been in a religious community? They didn't specify Christian or any other denomination or faith. They just said religious community in general. Have you been in one? What's that experience been like? And so we've gotten some of this data from that. 66% of trans people said they have been involved with a church at some point in their life. And now remember, this is sort of a weird pie thing, right? Because then 39% of trans people, so 39% of that 66%, so it's kind of like they're getting smaller here, have been part of a faith community but left because of fear of rejection. Then 42% of that 39% who have been rejected by a faith community have found a new one. So recognizing that the numbers are pretty small, but they're there, they exist. Trans folks exist in our communities. A lot of the time when we think about LGBTQ folks in general, if we don't, we tend to err on the side of thinking that those people are out there and we're in here, and that's not the reality of the situation. We have LGBT people in our communities. Statistically, it's super likely, even if nobody in your church is out, that somebody is LGBT, right? So keeping that in mind. This last bullet point here is the one that I think tells us the most about what we need to do. And this is a study from the Human Rights Campaign in 2012. They surveyed a bunch of LGBT-identified youth, and they asked whether their faith community was accepting. 35% said no, 15% said yes, and 52% said they didn't know. The reason that 52% is so important is because if you are part of a marginalized community, for your own safety, you have to assume that you are not welcome unless an explicit welcome is made to you. So the problem here is if 52% of our kids don't know what their church thinks, they have to assume that their church is not affirming of them or of people like them. Because it stands to reason, right? If you come out and the church rejects you, you've taken this huge risk and it has not paid off very well. And it's because they don't have that sense of trust, they're not ready to tell people about who they are. So, yeah, this 52% of all the statistics that I have on trans folks in faith communities, that's the one that bothers me the most, because it's like, well, if our kids don't know, and because we're not talking about it, what is that doing to their mental health? Any questions before we move on from these slides with all the numbers?
Can I just make a comment?
Yeah.
I found with our church is that it's different to be accepting and even welcoming than it is to be affirming. Mm-hmm. And I know for my own child, we grew up in this church, we always felt loved and feel loved. But at some point felt like it was because she was not really out. Mm-hmm. She still, and so she kind of went away. But still be involved in other communities within our church. So it's the affirming part that seems to be the most critical and the most difficult hurdle for congregations, because everybody can say, oh, we welcome everyone. Mm-hmm. Well, you welcome everyone as long as they look like you. Mm-hmm. And so that's been my reality and something that I've had to learn the hard way, because I thought I was being supportive of our daughter by saying, well, you can be who you are, because she was out in the love of the rest of her life. But maybe you shouldn't, you know, say things at church. Mm-hmm. And instead of being supportive of her, it really broke her heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
So anyway, we're all still working on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. That's something that has become super obvious as we've been doing more surveys about LGBT people in general within faith spaces, is that there's a huge difference between saying all are welcome and actually doing something to make that mean something, right? And even the churches that, you know, go through the process in their denomination and maybe become reconciling in Christ or a more light church or something like that, you can go through that process and hang a rainbow flag out front, but if you're not doing anything to actually make that happen, it doesn't help. I always encourage churches, we're going to talk more about this later, but I encourage churches, if you have a welcoming statement like all are welcome or something like that, I know it feels frustrating to be like, here is a huge laundry list of all the kinds of people we welcome. But like I said, if that welcome is not explicit to that particular kind of person, they have to assume that they're not welcome. So a lot of times when I go into a church and I read like on the back of this, on the back of the bulletin, it'll say like, we welcome everyone regardless of race or creed or faith. And you know, there's this long list. If there's not something in there about gender and sexuality, I'm a little bit like, okay, well then I have to assume you're not, right? Because you didn't say something about it. So yeah, just bringing that up. I saw a hand over here, Paul.
Well, Paul, there are some things that you would suggest that churches do to do something about the welcome Thursday.
Oh yeah, we're gonna like 3 or 4 slides from now. We're almost there.
And I would guess that being accepting is a relative, I mean, the leadership, the pastoral staff, and many of the congregation, and it may be an official expression of the congregation that they are accepting, but that doesn't mean that everyone within that fellowship is going to give you the same response.
Sure, yeah, and that's part of the hard thing for churches is there's a question about, do we make this decision from the top down and say, this is what we're going to do, and then try to get everybody to come along, or do we try to get a consensus before we do anything? And we all know consensus takes forever. So, like, how do we move this forward? And different churches are going to have different ways of doing that, for sure. Yeah. Anything else before we go on? All right. So, we've kind of got some information here about why trans allyship is important within sort of our larger context, right? But why is it important through a Christian lens? And this is not going to be any surprise to you, but we have a calling as Christians. God calls us to solidarity with the oppressed. And this is part of what's going on here when we look at the statistics for both mental health and murder rates for trans folks. There is a community here that is asking for help. And as Christians, we are called to respond to that in some way, right? I love, when I think about allyship, when I think about like what a good model for allyship looks like, I love that Christians basically have the perfect one, right? We have Christ as an ally. The Christ hymn in Philippians is the perfect example of this. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. And being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. The idea of God's solidarity with humanity, the idea that Jesus gave up power that he could have used to make the world whatever he wanted, and instead said, I'm going to be with humanity and I'm going to experience what this is like alongside humans, that's what allyship looks like. So when we need a model, we basically have one built into our faith system already. Just a couple of do's and don'ts about allyship. And if you've been to any, this is relevant to any sort of allyship that you're going to be doing, not necessarily just with LGBT people. So if you've been to an allyship training already, this might look familiar to you. But the idea here is that good allyship looks like all of these things here. The ones that I want to pull out are educating yourself. So good job, everyone. Good job. Explaining things to other people within your group. So once you learn the stuff, you can explain it to others, which is helpful. And then following the guidance of leaders within the marginalized group. You're listening to me, so again, congratulations. But recognizing that we also have this sort of bad allyship category where we act out of guilt, where we feel entitled to education, where we're constantly expecting cookies. And I'm just giving you some cookies right now, but I can't expect them. There we go. And then the last one is the one that I have found in my conversations to be the most common, which is getting defensive. It's really hard for us to talk about issues that surround our personal identity without feeling like we are personally invested, and so we can get defensive really easily. But recognizing that when we're in situations where we are called to help another group, we have to listen to what that group says about what they need, right? So that's kind of the general idea here. So just some conversation to get us talking here. When we talk about being compassionate people and working with compassion with other folks that are different than us, I love that the root for compassion is the idea of suffering with, right? The idea of, like Jesus does, suffering with humanity, right? And so it's, I think we can get caught up in the idea that we have to understand everything before we can be compassionate, or we have to understand everything before we can do something. And it's just important to note that you don't have to understand everything in order to affirm somebody's goodness and humanity, right? And we know that internally, but I think sometimes we need the reminder. So as we're thinking about how we don't have to know everything, I think it's helpful to sometimes think about what would I do in this situation, or how has this thing affected me? It can help us bring up some empathy, I think. So I've got some questions here for us. Go ahead and pick maybe one of the first three questions there. And if you could turn to your neighbor and pick one and see what kind of conversation it brings up for you. We're just thinking about how gender works in our society, even if you're not trans.
Which one?
Sure.
You want to do one?
Yeah.
sometimes a little bit sensitive for folks, but I would love to hear if anybody has anything they'd like to share about any of these questions, any stories that came up for them.
I guess I'll share. I'm an old guy, so I grew up, and I still feel this way, and I'm trying to work it out, that if you're born with the right equipment, that's what you are. And I never had any struggle with this type of thing. But I'm trying to be open-minded.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. It might be that you don't have maybe a specific memory that comes out for this, for any of these questions. Anybody else have anything?
When I was in my early teens, I dressed like a boy, like whatever that means. A lot of, I had liver hair, and I was constantly called sir and like he and put in the wrong dressing room. And at first I was like, oh, that's kind of cool, and like breaking the rule or like, you know, breaking the norms. And then it got to a point where I was like, yeah, this is wrong. Like, that's not who I am. And so, at the, like before when I had cut all my hair off, I was kind of experimenting with how I felt, and afterwards I was like, no, I like being a girl. And so that was really fundamental in shaping my gender.
For sure, yeah. There's a lot that's fascinating when it comes to gender expression, how we can sort of try on different kinds of gender expression, and then people react to us in a certain way because of that, and then our reaction to that is like, well, does this feel right or does this not feel right? If you've never had the chance to sort of play with gender expression that way, I would give it a shot sometime, even if it's something that feels maybe a little bit... I was just talking to somebody the other day about how it's come back around. This was a thing when I was in high school. Guys painting their nails black, and it's like, well, it's black, so it's like a manly color. But like you're painting your nails, right? And like something that just goes just a little bit outside of what kind of gender expression people might expect from you can give you a sense of like, why does this feel right or why does this feel wrong? There's a little bit of experimentation that can be really good for us in terms of trying to figure out our own identities, right? Mm-hmm. Other stories?
So I grew up in a family, two girls and a brother, two sisters and one brother, and my brother was given things because he was a boy. Mm. And that kind of made me a feminist. But what one of the things we were sharing in our group, and you come to more awareness now, is that also boxes in the boy. I was very jealous of my brother for a while, but I also kind of, you know, there was a lot of burden with that came for him too. So.
Yeah, that's something that we're talking a lot more about now in our culture at large, is the idea of toxic masculinity, the idea that it can look like it's great to be a man because you have a bunch of power, but turns out the minute you step a toe out of line, it's bad, right? Boys don't cry, right, for instance. And how does that stifle boys' emotional ability to express themselves, right? And when you can't express your emotions, you probably, the only emotion allowed for men is anger, right? And then that's the only way you have to express things. And I'm not saying that that's the case everywhere and for everyone. However, we recognize that much like whiteness boxes people in and hurts white folks as much as it, well, not as much as it hurts other people, but to an extent, the same thing can be true for masculinity. If we only allow a certain kind of gender expression, for instance, even if it's in a way where we kind of think, well, at least they get some power out of it. It's not always a great thing for people, right?
Well, relative to that, I remember I could never do anything athletic. And so I had a whole class laugh at me because I couldn't throw a ball more than 3 feet. Mm-hmm. But I never thought of it as gender related. Other than the fact that there was an expectation.
Right. And what do we say when somebody can't throw well? They throw like a girl.
I know.
Right? It's a gendered thing that people expect certain kinds of stuff from us. And when we can't measure up to that, or we feel like the ruler that's being used is not the right ruler, what do we do then, right? So the reason that I bring up these questions is because it's very much what we were talking about earlier about seeing the water we're swimming in. If we don't talk about when somebody asks me, when was the first time you knew you were trans, and I don't ask them, when was the first time that you knew you were the gender you are, like, we can't find a way to have a real conversation. So asking these questions of ourselves is a great way to think about how we can see the water we're swimming in, really, is what we're trying to do here. Anything else before we go on to the next bit here?
I was thinking about middle school-ish and noticing the girls that the boys were interested in, and they tended to be quite thin and quiet, and I was neither of those things. And there was somehow an expectation that if that was, I was going to be desirable, I was going to have to be a different version of what I was. And so I think that falls into that category of coming to terms and understanding, oh, that's what it actually means to be a woman, society says. I'm not that. So I don't know, that's the example.
Totally. Thank you for bringing that up. I think that's it highlights something that's important for us, which is there are, even within sort of, I come from like white Midwestern culture, right? Even within white Midwestern culture, there are different allowable ways to be men or be women, right? So you can be a woman, but not that kind of woman, or a man, but not that kind of man, and it's kind of okay because there are certain variations that are allowable, but then there are also certain variations that aren't allowable, right? And so trying to find the line between your identity and finding out the kind of person that you are without putting a toe over the line can be a difficult thing, and it's a lot of trial and error, I think, for a lot of us as teenagers is usually when that happens, right? But it's something that you can even notice as an adult sometimes. Thank you for sharing those stories. I appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit about one of the things that I find when we're talking about trans identities and trans folks in our communities is that there's a lot of fear about, oh my gosh, what if I say the wrong thing? There's a lot of fear. I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm going to offend somebody. It's going to be bad. So one of the ways that I have found, one thing I've found to be helpful is saying, here are some things not to say and why. And then you just know that those ones are off the table so you don't accidentally say them. So let's talk about things not to say. So let's just talk about these first four questions. If you laughed at these questions and you know why they're bad, that's good. But if you didn't, that's okay too. Let's talk about what's going on with these questions. The first question, have you had the surgery? Somebody give me an example of what's wrong with that question.
It's none of your business.
It's none of your business. I love it. Other reasons why that question might not be good.
Well, if you can ask that, then they can ask you all sorts of questions about you, so private, you know.
Fair. So, yes, it's a private thing. Anything else?
It assumes that surgery or physicality is the most important term.
I love that. Yeah, so it assumes that physicality or changes in that is the most important piece. Any other things about this first question? One more thing that I would say is, even within the question itself, it's assuming, one, that all trans people have surgery, and then two, just the way that it's phrased, the surgery, there is no the surgery. So even if you were going to ask that, which you wouldn't put a the in front of it, because there is no singular surgery that people have.
It's not better if you put it in air quotes?
It's not better. How about the second one here,
Can I say something there?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
There's also the assumption there that it's easy to have that surgery, and it's very expensive, and it's very, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it, and I mean, I don't know of any insurance that covers it, you know, et cetera. So, I mean, it's like, why don't you just go out and do that? Why couldn't you? Why would you not do the surgery? I mean, there's so many assumptions, and so many things that you don't understand by asking that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does sound a little bit like, did you get bread and milk at the store today?
Right.
Which is not like, not like that. It's not that easy. It's not that simple. It's not that uncomplex. Anyways, how about the second bullet point here?
Well.
Asking about people's real name or birth name. What issues do you see around this question and why you shouldn't ask it?
It devalues your present name.
Devalues your present name? Absolutely.
It's kind of like asking someone what's one of the nicknames they didn't like having when they were younger.
Ooh, I
it's
love that.
Bringing back something that may not have very good memories.
Yeah.
And that, sorry.
I didn't want to see your pronouns. I was just going to do it. What are your pronouns?
She, her, hers.
Thank you. She just said that it could, it's essentially like asking somebody, what's the worst nickname you've ever been called, and let me use that. Yeah, there's some sort of historical assumption here. And that was one thing that I really wanted to get to on this, is that curiosity about names is totally normal. And I'm one of those people that is really into names and name meanings. And so I get the curiosity that thing to be aware of is that for many trans people, their birth name has been used against them intentionally to make a point about how their identity is wrong and bad. Mm. And so keeping that in mind, you're not asking, like, it's not a neutral question. It could bring up a lot of trauma for somebody to essentially be like, please tell me what your family that excommunicated you calls you. I would like to call you that thing, right? There's a lot of possible trauma that could be there. So being aware of that question. Yeah.
It's like the Muhammad Ali, say my name.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. There's a sense of human respect that is involved in using the name that somebody uses. You wouldn't have somebody new come to your office and introduce themselves as William, and then you're like, well, Bill, great to meet you. Like, you would use the name that they introduced themselves with, right?
And if so, we had training at the beginning of last year in our school district, elementary school teacher, and we were instructed that if we have a third grader that comes to us and says, I want to be called Jane, and her name had been Joe before, you know, that we need to call her Jane, and we don't need to talk about that with the parents or at a parent conference, that legally they have the right to do that. That was just interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a complicated thing because the thing that they're, with guidelines around that, the thing they're trying to do is allow the person to be who they are, whether or not their parents agree with them or not. You know, and like, that's a realistic and good thing. The problems can come up around that, but like what they're trying to do is a good thing, that you're affirming who this person says that they are. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. How about this third one here? I never would have guessed, or you look great for a trans person. Any problems with this question or statement?
Stephen.
Sorry?
Demeaning.
It's demeaning, yeah.
It's based on, especially the second one, is based on the assumption that trans people can't be attractive.
Right, exactly. Based on the assumption, one, that you can tell, two, that trans people are all gross and weird.
And that there's a standard that once you transition, you're shooting for a standard, and so you're measuring your progress towards being able to display that, right. And that's great.
Yes, right. And this was something I talked about a little bit at the coffee talk that we had. There's a sort of understanding in trans communities that actually came out of black communities during the civil rights era, where there's this term called passing. The idea that you can pass and not be known for like the fact that you are trans, right, in this context. And for a lot of trans folks, there is this sense of the standard. Passing is the gold standard. You want people to not know that you're trans. However, not all people feel that way. Not all people feel like they want to pass or they want to not be known as trans, and some people can't for whatever reason. And so the idea that you put passing or being able to blend in as the thing that everybody is trying to get to is just sort of unrealistic and problematic for a lot of reasons. Yeah. How about the last one? This one is something I've seen a lot, actually, where people are talking about it and they're kind of like, well, I'm fine with it, but like, oh, it must be so hard for the family. And like, and while that may be true, it may be true, why might we not want to say that?
Because it's hard on a person. It's harder on a person than it is anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, that's a good first point, that it's like, this is not necessarily about who's having it harder. This is not the suffering Olympics.
I think it also might suggest that maybe you're not really fine with it, and you're just, but you don't want to say it.
Right. And that's really what I've seen in sort of the Midwest passive-aggressive, like, well, I'm okay with it, but this person, I can't imagine what they're thinking. It's like, well, you're saying it to you.
It doesn't say much for grandma either.
It doesn't say much for grandma either, yeah. Right, so these are all things that we want to just be aware of, the sort of issues, the problems and the issues that could come up around these questions. Again, I don't want to like shame anybody if you've ever said this kind of thing, but recognizing why it might be a problem can help us think about asking better questions. So, good questions. What's your name? Always a nice question. Can you remind me of your pronouns? I use that a lot in sort of my everyday, in that phrasing, because it makes it seem like not a big deal. Like, that phrasing has just worked for me, but you might find other ways to ask somebody about their pronouns. And we talked a little bit, too, about, how we do that without singling people out. How can I support you with that? If somebody is going through something, just ask how you can support them without assuming that they're maybe trying to get to some kind of standard that maybe they're not really trying to get, right? And then the last one is always a good question for people in marginalized communities who don't want to spend literally every day of their life explaining who they are. They're just trying to live their lives. Instead of saying, can you please explain this to me, say, what resource would you recommend on that? What can I read? What can I listen to? Who can I ask? So just not assuming, because it's hard to just sort of to live your life in a way that's sort of on display, even if you don't want to be on display, right? So just keeping that in mind. Asking for another third resource is always a good idea. So let's do a little bit of... Oh.
Similarly, I have a really good friend who, as a transgender child, now adult, and it was important for her to be able to find a resource to share with people in the family, neighbors, friends, because another story helped kind of explain the situation that she's been working through for a long time.
Yeah, and yeah, that's something that we've seen a lot of the sort of sharing of stories and background can be really helpful, not just in terms of education, but in terms of just people not feeling like they're so alone out there, which is really great. Let's do some pronoun practice. This is going to be some more turn to your neighbor stuff, so get ready to be extroverted. Here are some sentences, and we've got some examples of pronouns here, and I'm going to have you turn to your neighbor and work on these. You got some easy options there, she and he, and we're kind of familiar with those. They is a singular pronoun, is something that is going to maybe need practice if you're not used to it. And then I've got one here. There's all kinds of other pronouns out there in the world, y'all. It's really cool. But I picked one here. Z, zir, zirs, zirself. So this is essentially the idea. It was something that came about kind of in the late 60s where people were like, can we just have some gender-neutral pronouns in English? They have them in tons of other languages, but English doesn't have them. So we kind of started creating pronouns by mashing she and he and other things together. Now, it's much more common to have somebody who is non-binary use they-them pronouns, but not everybody does. Some people still use these new pronouns, newer pronouns, and so we want to practice with those as well. So, if you're feeling really ambitious, try that one. Try a little bit of everything, see what you can do. So turn to your neighbor and give these a shot.
It's an old, it doesn't have a
feedback on how that went. The one thing that I want to say is I may have some English teachers in the crowd tonight who might feel strongly about the they, them, their as a singular pronoun. And I want to say two things about that. The first thing I want to say is language changes over time, and respecting people's humanity is maybe more important in many circumstances than getting our grammar absolutely perfect. So that's one thing I want to say. The other thing I want to say is we have some historical precedent. I was going to pull these quotes up, and I didn't have time to put them on the slide. But both Shakespeare and Chaucer used a singular they. Mm-hmm. So, if we've got Shakespeare and Chaucer doing it, we don't really have a leg to stand on. So, what were some experiences that you had? How did this go?
Well, it was helpful for me because I was in a group recently, and everybody named their pronouns, mm-hmm. and there were several people there that used the they, them, their, mm-hmm. and so visualizing being there, and then just substituting here.
Yep.
So I think we had a pretty good time over here.
Yep.
good. Seven stars. Awesome. Yeah it's I guess one other thing I should say about pronouns that we are not as familiar with. Like, it's one thing to look at the name Mateo and go, okay, let's use she pronouns. And, like, that kind of changes things a little bit because you expect something about gender because of the name Mateo, right? But our brains still know she and her and he and his, and, like, we still know that, right? When we get our brains to do something like, say, they and them as a singular pronoun, our brains don't, we kind of have this, like, freeze moment where our brains are like, wait, what? And that's okay, because what's going on in your brain is you've got neural pathways that as you continue to run a neural pathway in your brain, it gets stronger and stronger. You've had a bajillion years of neural pathways that with using she and he pronouns, right? You may not have a neural pathway yet for they as a singular pronoun. The only way that you can get that neural pathway is by doing it, right? And what we know about how these neural pathways and how language works is that the only way that it works is by actually doing the sound with your mouth. You can't just think it. You have to make the sound with your mouth, and that's how your brain connects those things. So I often say to folks that are trying to get better at, for instance, they, them pronouns, do it while you're in your car, while you're, like, driving someplace, and you don't have to worry about people hearing you. But do it, practice it, say it out loud. Say sentences like this out loud, because that's going to get your brain oiled up for the right pronouns. There and then back there.
You said maybe it's more important to respect the individual than to get the grammar correct. Mm-hmm. Maybe would be more appropriate to say than to get the outdated, antiquated grammar correct. Mm-hmm. And if a name is historically male or female, mm-hmm. is it still inappropriate to assume that the gender identity matches the historical name?
Right. I mean, I think the thing that we're learning is that making assumptions, we know what assuming does to us, right? Yep. We know what assuming does. Making assumptions about the gender of a person based on their gender expression or based on their name can sometimes be wrong. Not always, but sometimes. And so erring on the side of not assuming is generally a better thing, I think. That's why you'll often find, I find this so helpful, something that has been in the corporate world, we've seen this more, where people are putting their pronouns in their email sign-offs. So if you've ever seen somebody email you and it'll say, like, the name and then their position and then their pronouns underneath it, so helpful. Just adding your pronouns to something. It's also helpful when the person you're emailing has a very gender-neutral name. How do you know what to use unless they've got their pronouns under there, right? So that's been something that I've found really helpful. Yeah, back there.
It's just been really helpful. I was really enjoying what you said. It's really important that we say it and practice it. Mm-hmm. And it's been really helpful because we have people that are more experienced in using the pronouns correctly. And so it's just like, it's important also to find other people to practice with in a safe way, mm-hmm. because we never want to practice on someone. I don't know. It's just like, find your safe people. Mm-hmm. It's been helpful for me. Because I'd never want to use it wrong with someone who I know is they, them, or there. I would much rather stumble in practicing with someone. That's it. Yeah.
Totally. I love the way you phrase that. Don't find someone to practice on. Find someone to practice with.
Yes. Yeah.
Austin, can you explain Z-Zer? I've never, ever heard this term in my life.
Yeah, no, it's okay if you haven't. So, like I said, some of these pronouns came about in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and are still used, but not as frequently as they is used, so that's why I'm getting us to practice they more often. But yeah, there's actually, I don't have a slide for it, but there is a really big list of different pronouns that have been sort of created because English just didn't have one readily available. And so if you find somebody who has pronouns and you see them and you're like, those are pronouns and I have no idea how to say them or what they are, people who have pronouns that are not ones that are considered, you know, common are usually really nice about being like, oh, you say it this way. So it's about kind of asking in that context, yeah.
You've mentioned this before, but it was coming up in our conversation that folks are at different proficiencies with using these pronouns in these situations, and so just recognizing it's okay to mess up.
Yes.
And you've mentioned to not make a big deal about it because that just makes it worse. Mm-hmm. And I think you've mentioned earlier this week also, like, you can just use the name.
Yeah.
It's like a quick backup if you're just getting tripped up in your
Exactly. Yep. And the thing, yeah, that I just will repeat that because I think I said this on another day, but if you screw up with somebody's pronouns, it's okay. You're learning. And it's not like, as long as the person that you're talking to knows that you mean well, they're not going to take offense at it and it's going to be okay. The important thing to remember is don't goof up a person's pronoun in one sentence and spend the next 5 minutes apologizing for it, because that makes it way worse. If you get somebody's pronoun wrong, just be like, oh, I'm sorry, I meant she. Not a big deal, because we all know you're working on it.
So is there a standard form for the verb with they? If they is singular, would you say they is?
Say again.
If they is being used singular, do you use the singular form of the verb or the plural form of the verb?
So, like, give me an example sentence.
Well, Taylor's mom is picking
them up from school.
Yeah, about one before. I wish I could go to the dance with Sabina. They
are so cool.
So you use the plural form.
Right.
Of the verb.
You do use the plural form of the verb. And like, it does. We essentially do that because that's just how our brains and tongues already want to work, and it didn't make sense to make it a singular thing and make people work extra hard. So we kept with the plural form of the verb there. So they are so cool. Does that clarify?
Yeah.
Any other questions?
You already, I think, mentioned it briefly, but I find it helpful when using they, them, their, is to realize that we already do that in situations when you don't know the gender.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, like if it's Taylor.
Yep.
Or in any of those situations, we do that naturally.
Exactly.
In circumstances.
So totally. Yeah, when the mail carrier brings mail and you want to know, you say like, well, what did they bring me? And you don't really think about the like gender or why you're doing it, right? It just feels kind of natural. So before we go on, let's run through these quick all together with they, them pronouns and see how it goes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was trying to find the pronouns that one of the people I met here would use. And it was a person that I thought would have their name mm-hmm. up on the board.
Uh-huh.
In the dining hall, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that several people, you had the person and the pronouns, several people had the person and no pronouns. Is that just a choice of the individuals that are up there on that board?
Right, that's just, if you don't make it, I think the general theme around Holden is that some people are using pronouns intentionally. Other people just haven't caught on the train yet, but it's not
okay.
It's not that they're being intentionally difficult.
Okay. I just thought when I noticed that some did, some didn't, I was just wondering.
Yeah, yeah. So let's run through these with they, them pronouns all together, all right?
Mateo loves birds. Their favorite is the toucan. Did you take Amanda's toy? They need that back. I wish I could go to the dance with Celine. They are so cool. Taylor's mom is taking them up after school. Tyrone wants to do it themselves.
Cool.
Self?
Themselves.
Themselves.
Yep. So, singular on that one. Yeah. So, is that, are we all good before we go on? Okay, cool. So let's talk about stuff your church can do. I know you've all been waiting for this. Here are the top five things that I have seen as the most helpful within church communities. And we're going to talk more about four and five, but the first three are somewhat self-explanatory. The two most important people to educate in your church are the people that work with your youth and the people that greet people at the door. Those are the two groups of people that are most important to educate about gender diversity. One, because if somebody's coming in your front door and is getting a bulletin and is, you know, kind of coming in for the first time and they get misgendered in that moment, you're probably not going to see them coming back. You might, but you might not. So greeters, educating greeters about pronouns and about respecting names is super important. With youth, it's important because our youth are the ones that are most likely to come out in our churches. And so just being aware of the fact that that's the most likely place that this is going to come up is within the youth group context.
And they're kind of ahead of us on some of the...
Yeah, the youth generally are ahead of us on this. In general, yes. Second one there, creating gender-inclusive facilities. So if you have any single-stall bathroom in your church, that can be a gender-neutral bathroom. It's so easy. You just put a different sign on it. Don't have to do anything. Don't have to do any remodeling. If your church doesn't have a single-stall restroom, that might be something to think about if your church is considering any changes in the future. A lot of times, if you have, for instance, one level of the church that has multiple men's and women's restrooms, you can pick one of those to make it a gender-neutral one. Usually, if you've got like two men's and two women's already, just make one of the men's gender-neutral because men get in, get out real fast. So you usually only need one. So think about ways to make bathrooms more accessible to gender diverse folks. Lots of trans folks, if you are a trans guy or a trans woman, and you are sort of like years into your transition and you don't really think about it, like me, it's not a big deal. But if you're somebody who's just coming out, or if you're somebody who is non-binary, the restroom thing is a big deal. And so keeping people safe by having a gender neutral restroom is really cool.
And what do you put on the door?
We usually put, there's a sign, you could do one with a symbol or without, but all gender restroom is the terminology that's used.
Unisex, is that okay?
Unisex is okay, it's just not as up and with it with the time. If you've already got a unisex one and it says unisex, you don't have to change it. It just kind of, the thing about language, and we've been talking about language and pronouns, language is meant to communicate ideas, right? What is the idea you want to communicate? Is the idea that you want to communicate in that sense, here is a bathroom for everybody, and then you just stop there? Unisex is great. If you want to communicate, here's a bathroom for everybody, and we know something about gender diversity, you put all gender restroom on there, and that communicates that. Yeah.
I heard about a church that they need funding for a bathroom to make it gender inclusive, and so they got funding from the government to make it also handicap accessible.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a backdoor way if you don't have the funds.
Right. That's a great idea. That's something that I've seen in several churches. If you are already doing work to become ADA accessible, you can use that as a point to put in a gender neutral restroom because you're already doing the ADA thing anyways. That's great.
Can you just say restroom?
Yeah, you could just say restroom. I've seen
there a reason to be more specific.
Right. I've seen if it just says restroom on the door and it's a single stall, single occupancy, most people know what that means. Yeah. It's just the language that is generally being used is all gender restroom to make it more explicit. It's again that sort of being explicit so that people know for sure, so that they feel safe. That's the idea. Yeah.
And normalizing it.
And normalizing it, yeah, exactly. Other questions or thoughts on that one? Okay. The third one there, provide opportunities for people to tell you about who they are. And I mean that in a couple different senses. One is, like I used the example of the name tag Sunday with your pronouns on it. That's an example of a time where you are creating a really low stress way for people to tell you about who they are. Instead of being like, hey, anybody who would like to tell us about a new name or pronouns, please stand up. You're like, that puts a lot of pressure on somebody, right? When you're doing it in the course of everyday events, that's what I mean, is you're creating a space that's it's lower risk for people to talk about what's going on with them. So if somebody comes to church one day and they've always used he, him pronouns, and then that Sunday they put she, hers on their name tag, then it's like people might have some questions, but it's way less of a giant announcement than it would be otherwise, right? Another thing I mean by that third one there is by providing space for conversation. So within dinner time, within the context where your church, for instance, maybe they never talk about gender diversity at all, you therefore never have a space or an opportunity for people to talk about what's going on with them when it comes to gender diversity. But say you're doing a book group, or say you're on a book about gender diversity, or say that you're having a coffee talk hour where you're going to talk about a news article that came up and it includes gender diversity. That is an opportunity for people to get in and be like, well, this is what my experience is, right? So providing those opportunities for conversation are important. So then the last two I want to focus on a little bit more, using inclusive language and encouraging leadership by trans folks. So let's talk about inclusive language. Inclusive language shows up in a couple of different ways here. We use language about God and inclusive language about God. A lot of us have gotten kind of, like, we know about this. We know about the idea that gendered language in reference to God can change how we think about God, right? That quote about if God is male, then male is God, right? Like, we've kind of understood a little bit about how the language we use affects our perception of the divine. So thinking about the language that we might use in our liturgy that reflects that, and how do we deal with that? So the example I've got here is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the Trinity, right? And I'm not saying don't use Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I'm just saying we need to think about the ways that we use gendered language. So a lot of churches have moved to from constantly using Father, Son, and Holy Spirit to sometimes mixing it up with Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer, non-gendered ways to refer to the Trinity, right? So that's just one possibility. I was in the library earlier, and there's a book in there in the religion section specifically about non-gendered ways to refer to the Trinity, and I was like, oh, cool, I've never seen this book in my life. But, like, people have been thinking about this, right, thinking about how we refer to God without making God male all the time. Because then when we talk about being made in the image of God, it seems like only male people are made in the image of God if God is male, right? So we got to think more about that. Language, when we use language about our communities, when we use languages about our congregation, we can sometimes slip into gendered language. And, like, we have made this great leap where it used to just be brothers in Christ, and now we at least have brothers and sisters in Christ. We've made some movement there, right? But recognizing that not everybody identifies as male or female, how might they hear the phrase brothers and sisters in Christ from the pulpit and kind of go, oh, but not me, right? So there's one way that you can change that is by saying brothers and sisters and siblings in Christ, or just siblings in Christ. It's a non-gendered way to refer to a group of people. It's why I am so fond of the word folks, because it's a non-gendered way to refer to a group of people, right? And there are ways that we can do that within our sort of liturgical context as well. And then on this last one here, language and music. How do we organize? So we are super good at saying, you know, men on stanza one, women on stanza two. One thing I noticed the first night I was here at Holden, which I loved, is that they said low voices on stanza one and high voices on stanza two, right? So rather than splitting it up by gender, you can just split it up musically, which makes a lot more sense when you think about it. Unless you're singing one of those hymns that's like, men the conquering, blah, 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 and then it doesn't make sense. So maybe don't say those things. And then there are some worship songs and changes like this one from the Chalice Hymnal is a great example. Music is so complex because when you try to change language that's already been fixed in one way, you don't just think about how is this going to sound to people? You also have to think about meter and rhythm and like how it's going to work that way. And so music is really complex. But people have been doing it for a long time, including this change in Be Thou My Vision, which I really like. But there are also one of the ones that I've seen the most variations for is the doxology, right? Praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. That last line has been like played with in a bunch of different ways to become more gender inclusive in terms of like how we understand God and the Trinity. So if you just look up gender diverse or gender inclusive doxology, you'll find a ton of different examples of that. Any questions about this slide before we go on?
Just to add to it, I confess I'm sure I've been guilty of it, but to your second point, I often hear kids referred to as, hey, boys and girls.
Uh-huh.
So wondering if you have a tip, what is it best to just say kids?
Yeah, right. It's our... One of the things that we're working on, we're working with there, is not just how do we make it gender neutral, but our brains also want it to be a pair. We also want to say, hey, blank and blank, because that's just like what we're used to listening to. One of the things that I've seen with grade school teachers is they just put anything in there. They're like, hey, aliens and cowboys. Like, they literally pick anything because they're just talking to a group of kids and it doesn't really matter. Kids is the one that I tend to go with. But if you talk to somebody in education with younger kids, I've heard a bajillion different versions of that.
In our school, friends.
Friends. Yeah, I love friends.
This is something I thought of recently. I remember in school, like grade school, we got sat boy, girl, boy, girl.
Uh-huh.
And I can see like the advantage of that, right? You get to experience people with different, you know, genders, and it makes the classroom experience more valuable. Is there another way that, like, let's say I was organizing a Sunday school?
Right.
How do you do that?
A lot of times when we're trying to break people up into two groups, we default to gender because that's the one we're like, well, that's the basic. Here you go, you know. But I've been noticing when Melinda is preaching, like the other night when she was trying to get two folks on either side, she was like, "Do you like dinosaurs or do you not care about dinosaurs?" Like, you can literally use anything. The main things that I've seen used are. Like favorite color, if you're going to do a bunch of groups, you can kind of say, like, here's four colors, which one's your favorite? You can line up that way. Lining up by what month your birthday's in. Lining up, if you're going to split into two, you can line up by do you like chocolate or vanilla? You know, like, you can pick any binary in the world and we'll line kids up that way. That's not by gender.
Shoelaces, non-shoelaces.
Shoelaces,
no
shoelaces.
Button on, do not have a button on. We do it a billion ways.
Yes, there you go.
Can you tell me again what your example for Father, Son, and Holy Spirit was?
Oh, Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer.
Thank you.
I really love that variation. There has been some pushback from some theologians who say that that's modalism, that you are then...
Modalism?
It's a theological... Basically, it means you're ignoring the fact that... Like, if you say Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer, you're associating Creator with God the Father, Redeemer with Jesus, which then would mean that Jesus is not also a Creator, and the Holy Spirit is not also a Sustainer, or God is not also a Sustainer. So it's a theological thing that if you don't care super much about it, it's fine. But if you're somebody who is not a fan of modalism, you might not be a fan of that particular version.
What do you do with the ending of the doxology? Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer.
I'm trying to think of like what I have heard recently.
Creator, Christ, and Holy Ghost.
Creator, Christ, and Holy Ghost. Yeah. You all probably have a lot more examples than I do off the top of my head because I'm tired from hiking. If you Google it, you'll find a bunch of show you a couple of folks here. When I talk about trans leadership and leadership from gender diverse people within the church, sometimes people are like, "We don't have any of those. Where are they?" We do have some, and they're great. This, for instance, is M. Barclay. M is the first trans deacon in the United Methodist Church, and as you may know, that's a big thing right now for the Methodists. M, and actually M's partner as well, who is also non-binary, are both in a situation where they may have their deaconship revoked within the near future. We'll see how that goes. But they are a couple of the forerunners within the United Methodist Church. And they also, if you are a pastor, you gotta get connected with Enflesh. Enflesh is this newsletter that they send out before every Sunday that if you're preaching on the lectionary, they basically say, here's some ways of understanding the lectionary in light of gender diversity, and it's super helpful. So I would highly recommend checking that out.
What is it called again?
It's called Enflesh. It's on that third one. Third bullet point. Somebody else you might have heard of or may not have, Deborah J. Hopkins, is a trans woman who spoke out against the first bathroom bill that sort of went through in North Carolina. Deborah was she did speak in the past at this hearing for this bill. And the fact that she is a black trans woman who was willing to get up on something that was going to be nationally televised in favor of, like, not having this bathroom bill that would restrict so much movement for trans folks was a really gutsy thing to do, like, really gutsy. And so she is currently doing a couple of different faith-based projects through her church. And you can find out more about her at that link down at the bottom. Within the ELCA, Megan Rohrer was actually our first trans pastor in the ELCA. Megan pastors in San Francisco. Megan is a non-binary person, and there's this, everybody always likes to argue about firsts, who was the first what. Megan was the first trans person ordained in the ELCA, but they didn't come out as trans until after ordination. So technically, the first out trans person to have been ordained was Asher O'Callaghan, who he got his ordination just 2 or 3 years ago, and he's in Denver right now. And then we just had the, last year, the first trans woman of color ordained in the ELCA is Nicole Garcia, who's also pastoring in Denver. So a lot of good people in Denver and California. Lawrence Richardson is a pastor in my neck of the woods in Minnesota. He is a pastor at Linden Hills. And actually, now I'm second guessing that because I think he might have just changed churches, so I've got to check on that. But he's great. He also works with the Center for Progressive Renewal in educating pastors. And so, like, having a trans person who is a pastor educating pastors is really, really cool. So he's up in the Twin Cities. So I'm going to pass out a handout here. The first side of it that we're looking at here is this sort of matrix that I've got, which it kind of just is a, you don't have to go in order here, is my point. You can go in order if you want. It tends to go in order, but you don't have to go in order. On the back of the sheet here, I've got specific bullet point suggestions for individuals and then for churches. And so I'm going to pass these around while we talk about this. Pass this way. That way.
Austin, is a lot of this information in your book?
This particular stuff, not all of it.
But like...
a bunch of it, but not all of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So just a word on this slide here. Like I said, you don't have to go in order here, but things tend to go in order. Congregations tend to start with some kind of education about gender diversity, and then tend to move into a conversation about how this is actually going to work, and having some internal conversation is important.
Yes.
We're going to get everything.
I'll bring some up.
Okay, cool. Yay! Good. Glad. Yeah, if we need any more, Sharon can grab us more. So we tend to start out with education. We tend to start out with something like this, where the church gets together and is like, let's learn some stuff. You then move into some kind of conversation where internally you have conversations about what we want to do. You have to come to some kinds of consensus, even if it's just the consensus of the board of the church. Or conversation and then consensus, right? When it comes to connection, a lot of folks know that within their denomination, you probably have an LGBT organization within the ELCA. Reconciling works. But basically, every Christian denomination has an LGBT advocacy organization. So if you literally Google whatever denomination you want plus LGBT, you'll find them. They're there. And weirdly enough, Wikipedia has a great entry that lists almost everybody on there. So Wikipedia is great in that regard. After you've done this, after you've done, you started with education, you've had some conversation, you've made some decisions, you've connected with large organizations, then you actually have to decide what you're going to do, right? and so that's why that second half of the sheet there, or the second other side of the sheet, has some examples on there for what you can do as an individual and as a church community. So I'm going to leave that with you. We've only got a few minutes left, so I want to just give us a couple of scenarios to talk about. One thing that I've found is that I tend to, if I'm not prepared for something, if something happens that I'm not prepared for, I freeze. That's sort of my immediate reaction. And then later on, I'm like, gosh, I wish I would have said that, or I wish I would have done that. One of the antidotes to that kind of thing is practicing a scenario before it actually happens in your community, right? So I want us to just talk about a couple of different scenarios. So here's scenario number one. You're just leaving coffee hour when you see Dave, a mainstay of the congregation, talking with Megan, a new member of your church. Megan has told you that she's transgender, and so far there haven't been any issues that you know of. You overhear Dave say to Megan, "It's so great to meet you. Megan probably wasn't always your name, though, right? What's your real name?" So turn to your neighbor for, actually, no, let's do this as a large group. What would you do in this situation? And I know this is going to depend on, are you the pastor? Are you just a congregant? Are you on the church board? I know sometimes the power dynamics play in there. But what would you do in this situation if you overheard a conversation like this?
Kick Dave.
What was that? Kick Dave? Go ahead.
Again, not sure this is the perfect reaction, but I'd probably try and avert, like, the scenario, like, kind of redirect to the scenario. So I'd probably say, "Hey, Megan, can I show you around?" Or, "I'd love to, you know, talk to you about a couple things." And then, like, later, maybe when she's, like, or they've already left, then I'd say, "Hey, Dave, that's not really an appropriate thing to say."
Yeah, so that's a great point. A great possibility there is not addressing what's going on in the moment, but kind of breaking that moment and then addressing it individually later. That's a really great way of thinking about that. Other possibilities?
Well, I think you could just, without being demeaning to poor Dave, just say, "You know, I think Megan is her real name." Mm-hmm. Just leave it at that.
Yeah, just make a statement about your relationship to Megan in that moment and affirming that.
You said something like, "I think dead name is the correct term." You know, I don't think Megan probably wants to talk about that.
Yeah, so just saying, and that's a tricky one because you also don't want to, like, speak for Megan if Megan does want to say something about that. So, like, you don't want to cut Megan off in this scenario to not answer for themselves. But, like, yeah, saying something about, like, maybe that's not a question that Megan wants to answer. That way, then, it allows a little bit of opening. Yeah. Any other ideas?
Well, I'm wondering if it would be appropriate, like we're having this training right now, to think about having a training in your church that's not just directed at Dave, but because he might not be the only person
right. Who
would screw it up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So recognizing that in the moment, maybe the only thing to do is to just sort of break that moment again to sort of, like, make sure Megan's okay. But after that, realizing this is probably not a one-off thing. Maybe lots of people have questions, and doing a larger education session based on this.
But doing that before Megan decides to come to your church.
That's also a great idea. Yeah.
So, I mean, like, just doing it ahead of time, doing it now,
right. Instead
of Dave coming along.
Yeah, being ahead of the game is a big thing. Lots of churches are like, "Well, this isn't really something we have to think about," and then a kid comes out, and now you got to think about it, and you haven't prepared. So thinking about getting ahead can be nice.
If we don't have an out trans person in the church, and I haven't thought about this in my church, so I actually don't know that answer, but if you didn't have one to lead that education session,
yeah. How
do you feel about having a cis person lead a session like that, or should we bring in an outside expert?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would, first of all, say it's probably not a good idea to ask a trans person within your congregation to do this.
Okay.
They might offer to do it. Asking, it can be okay if you know them really well, like if you're already really good friends, but just being like, "Hey, you're the only one I know, could you please do this?" is kind of like really putting that on them, right? So maybe not a great idea. In terms of having a cisgender person lead a training like this, I think there are ways that it can be done well, but it's a real kind of hard needle to thread. So I would recommend seeing if there are folks in your area that can do a training. And it doesn't even have to be a faith-specific one. For instance, in Minnesota, we have a group called Out Front Minnesota that does all the LGBT lobbying. They go and do trainings like this all the time. So if you have an LGBT advocacy organization in your state, they will be thrilled to send you somebody who can do a training like this.
I found it interesting, two times when we were talking about this specific situation, I heard the language, "poor Dave."
Mm-hmm.
And it gets me. One of the things that really, if you call Dave out, that will become the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, "Well, you called me out in front of my peers,
mm-hmm.
and I'm poor Dave
mm-hmm.
for being called." Instead of Dave Dave, we've had, I mean, I could see having all this education stuff in a certain Dave, you know, still not bothering, you know, and at some point, I don't mind calling him out.
Right. I think it, like, you know, a lot of this is all based on context, and the context is going to determine what you do. If this is a situation where you've already done trainings, Dave's already been talked to about this, that's the point where you have to be like, okay, we got to go to the pastor, we got to have the pastor say something, right? And there's got to be some kind of movement there. But if this is a one-off, there's been no training, nobody knows any different, then you have a different reaction. So yeah, it really is context dependent.
Would Megan be upset if you stepped in and said, excuse me, Dave, I've always wondered if you're circumcised?
I mean, you could really call everybody out. All right, I want to get on to our next situation. All right. Let's actually go with this one here. This one is a tough one, so I want us to take a look at this real quick. You're a youth minister at a large church with about 30 kids in your high school youth group. One of your kids, Sam, has recently come out as trans and is going to begin transitioning. A week before you're about to head out to on a summer service trip, you get a phone call from a parent of another kid in your group. This dad has heard about Sam and wants to know which bathrooms and bunk rooms Sam will be using on the trip. You can tell this father is genuinely concerned about the safety of his kid, is Sam around. This is a tough one. Thoughts? Anybody? I should say right up front, there's no perfect answer to this question. It's open.
I would say it's not your right to know, and if you feel uncomfortable with your kid going on the trip, then you can have the right to pull your kid from the trip.
So that's a possibility, that if you don't feel comfortable with your kid on this trip, then maybe it's not the right place for them. That's one possibility.
I think it'd be good to ask, what are your concerns?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And start a dialogue.
Yeah.
Because that can be really helpful.
Right. So if you didn't hear that, asking about specific concerns to start a dialogue, I think that's a great idea. I find that, like, when I talk with people and they're like, well, I just don't agree with transgender people, or I don't think that's a real thing or whatever, that you can't have a conversation with that because it's just a statement. You have to be like, well, what specifically are you concerned about? And then we can talk about those specific concerns. It may be that Sam's dad has no idea about, you know, any of the safety procedures that are in place for all the students already and doesn't know what's going to happen and just needs to know more about how things are going to go. It may not even be that big a deal that Sam is trans. Maybe this dad just hasn't heard about the child safety procedures in the church, right?
I would say reassure the parent that you're also concerned that safety is a top priority for you, and that you wouldn't do anything that wouldn't jeopardize their child's safety.
Right. So really affirm that, like, we understand this is not coming from, like, this may be coming from more of a biased place, but it may just be that this parent is literally like, how are you going to take care of my kid, and that's all I care about, right? Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, yeah, really affirming, like, we're going to do everything to keep your kid safe, and here are the procedures that we have in place, and we want to keep Sam safe, and we want to keep your kid safe, and that's top priority for us, right? And really affirming that.
Well, just backing up, so you're the youth pastor, and this is a new situation, and how do you guys decide where Sam's going to sleep?
Right, so that's like another big question, right, for youth pastors. If you're going to go on a trip that's overnight, how do you decide that? And that is going to be a very specific thing based on the situation 90% of the time. 90% of the time it's going to be something that's specific to a congregation. One thing that I've seen work is having specific, like, this is where it gets complicated, because if you're going to have a specific non-gendered sleeping area that also has, like, adult chaperones in the room,
right,
it's nice in one way, because you're like, well, here's the boys, here's the girls, and here's the non-gendered sleeping area, and you can do that really well if you've got good chaperones and you've got good adults in the community. It's not really a big deal. It can, however, make the kids who want to be in that gender neutral room feel outside, like outsiders, mm-hmm, right? And that's kind of another concern to be aware of. So basically, the one thing that I have found to be true in every situation, regardless of context, is if you have good and well-trained adult volunteers, that's the main thing. And at that point, you know, that's the thing that's going to make the biggest difference, is making sure that the adult volunteers are trained and that you've got a good ratio of adults to kids.
Well, would you start by having a discussion with the child and what their preference is? Or?
Right, yeah. Starting with where are you most comfortable is a great, like, you can't assure them in that moment that they're going to get what they want, but hearing what would work best for them is a great place to start.
And their family.
What about application forms for events where gender is, you ask for gender?
Sure, so.
I mean, are there better ways to do that?
Yeah, so if you have a form, a sign-up form for people, rather than having check a box male or female, usually I will just have an open line that says gender, and you write in, and that's the easiest way to do it. And most people will be like, most people won't notice that it's a thing, but for the people for whom it is a thing, they'll be really grateful that it's a write-in area. If you are in, for instance, a medical setting where it might be necessary to know somebody's assigned sex because of a medical thing, then it's easiest to put sex assigned at birth and then gender as both open fields. So we are pretty much out of time. So the last thing I want to say here is that this stuff is complicated, and it's going to depend a lot of the time on your situation and your church, right? But I hope that some of the stuff on these sheets can be helpful in terms of getting started and ideas, and that you'll be able to find ways to connect with other organizations. So let me... Oh, I was going to test you. You got out of the test. My contact info is here. If you are looking for more resources and you don't know where to look, you can always email me. If you've got a question about all this, please do email. I've also, if you didn't get a chance to get one of the LGBT resource lists, faith resource lists, I've got a bunch of them, and I'm going to put them up here so you can grab one going out. This has, like, books and all kinds of stuff on it that you might want to read. So I think that's about it. So thank you so much for being here with me tonight.